I'm Brian Ellison, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Think back to when you were 24 years old. What were you doing? I'll wait. Time's up. So at 24, David Litt was writing speeches for the most powerful man in the world. We'll hear how he shaped some of President Obama's most memorable and hilarious words. And we'll ask about life in the inner circle, including that time he deplaned Air Force One in his pajamas. Then we'll tackle this week's Kansas Supreme Court ruling that said a new school funding formula is still inadequate and inequitable. We'll find out what advocacy groups think about the decision, just the latest in a long battle over potentially hundreds of millions of tax dollars. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. In 2008, just like in most election years, a lot of college students got consumed with politics. Swept up in a message about hope and change, they joined campaigns, they abandoned learning and real money in some sort of idealistic belief that they could change the world. A lot of them dream about getting a job for the candidate they so admire and work so hard for. Every once in a while, eventually, one of them actually does. David Litt was one of those. He worked in the Obama White House for the better part of two terms as a speechwriter, eventually rising to special assistant to the president, which means he could order frozen yogurt from the takeout window at the White House mess. These days, he's the head writer and producer at Funny or Die's Washington, D.C. office, and he joins us this morning from NPR Studios in New York. David Litt, welcome to Up to Date.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you. And those years in college, you say that you were an Obama bot in those years. What does that mean?
Well, I actually titled one half of my book, Thanks Obama. I wrote a memoir about my time there. And I titled one half of it Obama bot because it was originally a sort of derogatory term that people who didn't support Obama or didn't get why people like me were so excited about him would say. But I actually felt like, in a way, it wasn't that far from the truth. I didn't choose to believe in Barack Obama. It felt almost like the political equivalent of falling in love, you know, kind of that all-consuming crush. And one of the things that I gradually came to realize during my time in Washington was trying to figure out how to balance being aware and thoughtful and critical, not criticizing, but thinking through what happened to me, with believing and having those ideals that brought me to Washington in the first place.
So let's talk about you going to Washington in the first place. As you mentioned, you've written a book. It's out just last month. Thanks, Obama, My Hopey, Changey White House Years. And you didn't get that job in the White House right away when Obama first took office.
I definitely did not. I moved to Washington without a clear idea of what I was going to do. I mean, I really did think Barack Obama is in D.C., hope and change are in D.C., so I should be in D.C. And also, I had moved back in with my parents in New York City, where I grew up. So it was very easy for me to say, you know, I think I need to get out of here. And that's why I moved to Washington. And for a time, I was probably the world's worst intern. Every Washington, D.C. intern dreams of going rogue. And it turns out none of them actually do it, except I did it. I was at a crisis communications firm, and for a variety of reasons, most of them involving my own immaturity and obnoxiousness at the time, I started bringing in my laptop from home and working out of the break room. I abandoned the office they gave me, the cubicle I had. And I also began playing Minesweeper instead of working, and then I would only answer work-related questions in analogies to the game of Minesweeper I was playing. It was a real intern cry for help.
And yet, and yet you persisted.
Yes, I guess.
You call that place Crisis Hut in your book.
I do. It's one of those places where I don't think I was allowed to use the actual name of the firm, so I just called them the Crisis Hut. And I will say, not many interns almost get fired. It is very hard to nearly get fired as an intern. And not many interns who go rogue like that are lucky enough to get a second chance, but I was.
You eventually do find your way through some connections to the White House. You start by working for Valerie Jarrett.
Yes. So my first boss at the White House, my first principal, that's sort of in speechwriter jargon, the principal is the person who gives the speech, was Valerie Jarrett, the president's senior advisor. And Valerie was a particularly unique figure in the White House because she knew Michelle Obama and Barack Obama back from when she interviewed Michelle Robinson for a job, and Michelle Robinson introduced her to her fiancé, Barack. So, I mean, they really, she had been along this entire journey with them. And it was a very lucky thing in a lot of ways because by writing for Valerie and hearing Valerie's stories, I got to know a side of the president and the first lady that I might not have otherwise encountered because Valerie was so personally close and had so much history with them.
Is there some element of working for one of the president's advisors, but not the president himself, that is somehow disappointing? Or you're not quite in the center of the action? Maybe tell us how speechwriting works. Are you all on one big team?
Jon Favreau, who was the chief speechwriter at the time, he was generous enough to say, well, you can sit in on the presidential speechwriting meeting. So I got to sort of feel like part of the team. But my job was to write for Valerie and the senior staff. I have to say, I did not feel disappointed by this. I felt totally surprised that I was 24 years old and they let me through the gates of the White House. I mean, I felt that way more or less when I left the White House at 29 and was a special assistant to the president. So it was, you know, I would sit in on the speechwriting meetings for the president, and it was incredibly cool just to listen to. I remember one of the first meetings, I forget who said it, but they were talking about an event and, you know, what the remarks were going to be. And someone said, so what should he say? And I remember thinking, like, no one knows. There's not a book somewhere where, you know, somebody's like, oh, this is the remarks for next week. And it was that incredible realization that no matter how special this place is, no matter how extraordinary these people are, we're also just all people trying to figure it out. And to get to be part of that in a small way, was both exciting and sometimes a little terrifying.
Now, you eventually do join the president's staff, and ultimately you become senior staff as a special assistant to the president. What does that mean exactly? Or maybe put this in terms I would understand. Who were you on the West Wing? Were you Will Bailey? Were you Sam Seaborn?
The way I always put it, Sam Seaborn is Rob Lowe's character on the West Wing, the speechwriter character. And the only way in which I was Rob Lowe's character clearly was in terms of good looks.
Yes,
other than
right.
that, and this is radio, so no one has any proof.
that's my success story as well.
Yeah, exactly. But I was more or less the person who hands a piece of paper to Rob Lowe and then scurries out of the frame. I was not the chief speechwriter. That was Jon Favreau in the first term, Cody Keenan in the second term, and I was one of a team of eight. So even when I was on the senior staff, technically, I was on kind of the junior rungs of the senior staff. There would be a 7:30 a.m. meeting that only a handful of people would get to go to with the chief of staff. And then there would be a 9 a.m. meeting that was kind of much broader and, you know, for 30, maybe even 40 people. And I was in the 9 a.m. I was not a 7:30 a.m. person. It still was an extraordinarily special experience. I mean, you start your day in the Roosevelt Room. You know, you're looking at, you know, on one side of the room is all of the banners and the campaign ribbons from all of the branches of the armed services. There's the Nobel Peace Prize that Teddy Roosevelt won in 1906 that's just sitting there on the wall. So you feel that sense of history every day. But it was one of the things about the real White House, as opposed to the fictional White House as we see on TV, is there's just a lot more people in the real White House. It doesn't it's a team effort. And when I say it's a team effort, that includes hundreds, thousands of people like me who were working, you know, not necessarily making history every day, but just trying to do our little part of this big thing as well as we possibly could.
So you may have been among the junior rungs of the speechwriters, but you really did have a very important role in certain kinds of speeches, and often that was the funny stuff. Your job was often to write humorous speeches, things like the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Also sounds like a lot of funny stuff happened to you, which you share a lot of in the book, which I want to ask about one of those. Air Force One, you got to ride on from time to time. You confessed that you ate a lot during those trips, but you were also caught in a less than ideal state of dress at one point.
Yes. Well, the Air Force One, I make clear in the book, you know, a lot of the things about the White House are not quite as amazing as you might think. Air Force One is exactly as amazing as you might think. It is, you know, it is a pretty amazing, just special experience. It's hard to put into words just how cool it feels to be pulling up on the tarmac to that plane and getting in and, you know, it taking off and realizing, I was about to use a word that wasn't appropriate for the radio.
Thank you. Yeah.
I'm on Air Force One, but that's mm-hmm. how, you know, that's how great it is. And I will say, just because I think it's appropriate here, there was a time when I flew to and from Kansas City. We were doing a speech about manufacturing that day. I think it was a Ford plant. Flew to and from Kansas City and then got back, got in my car and drove to the airport and flew coach that night to get to a friend's wedding on the West Coast. And, you know, I was stuck in the middle seat and, like, no leg room. And I remember desperately wanting to look to my seatmates and just saying, like, by the way, I took an earlier flight today. You want to hear about it? But it didn't work. So anyway, I was on Air Force One going to Germany. And I had never been on an overnight international trip before. And what I didn't realize is the line to change back from pajamas into business clothes gets really, really long. And I had an early speech, and I was in pajamas, and the only pajamas I owned were covered in pictures of the Incredible Hulk. And I remember thinking, I bought these pajamas my freshman year of college, and I remember thinking, oh no, President Obama, if he has any edits to the speech, I'm going to have to go up to the senior staff cabin or to his office in the front of the plane in my T-shirt and Hulk pajamas to give him edits. This is not going to go well. What am I going to do? And I had a genius idea, which is I'm just going to duck into the coat closet and quickly change into my suit, which is already hanging there, and no one's going to be the wiser. And so I slipped into the coat closet and was about halfway through the changing process when Luke, our trip director, opened the closet door and discovered me with, you know, Hulk pajamas at my feet in my underwear. And of course, the coat closet opened up onto the rest of the cabin. So all of my colleagues were there just kind of like giving me a look that was like, well, your presidential legacy is your White House legacy is secure. It might not be what you wanted, but that's what you got. And something I left out of the book, but I always thought was funny, was that apparently this was a popular enough story that on other international trips that I was not on, I heard about people sort of trying to see if they could do it. Like some fairly important people in government, you know, stepping into the coat closet, like trying it out, replaying the story for the benefit of other colleagues who weren't there to watch me personally embarrass myself.
Well, I'm sure they were all sorry to miss that. You do tell about several stories about the times that you interacted directly with the president, although they didn't necessarily come quickly during your tenure there.
Yeah, one of the things for me that made it exciting to write a book like this was that I did interact with the president fairly regularly, especially the longer I stayed at the White House. I got to the point where, somewhat surprisingly to me, going into the Oval Office and getting edits or going over jokes was part of my job. But because so many of my interactions with President Obama involved joke writing, I got these glimpses of things that played out in much more important decisions or much more historic moments, but through the prism of jokes and through the prism of humor. And so, for example, I talk about watching President Obama record a taping we were going to play at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, just a funny one-minute audio clip. And the first time he recorded it, it was fine, but it wasn't great. And I was worried because we only had one more take. And the second time he recorded it, it was like he had been practicing for a week. And I knew he hadn't. I was sitting next to him the entire time. But somehow he had just, in an instant, figured out what is the most important part of every joke. What word do I need to emphasize? And how do I emphasize that? And that ability to dial in on the most important part of an issue and execute on that top priority and block out all the distractions. That was not that important in a joke. I mean, if that little one-minute tape hadn't gone perfectly, no one would care. America would still be the same. But that ability that I saw in President Obama in that moment made me think about some other moments that that I kind of witnessed at the White House and that we all did as Americans in a different way. So it was fun to be able to write about that.
As you look back and reflect on the president's legacy, or at least the impact of his work and the parts you were there for, as well as the parts you weren't, what are your observations now, you know, a year and a half since you left the White House and, you know, a year after he did?
Well, I think that where we are as a country is not where I expected we would be when I left the White House in January of 2016. And Trump's presidency is, at least for me, dangerous and frightening in ways that have nothing to do with political party, but have everything to do with this trend toward authoritarianism and a trend toward breaking rules and norms that have kept us intact as a country for a long time. All that said, the words that inspired me to join the Obama campaign were very specific. I remember President Obama saying in a speech, "Faced with impossible odds, people who love this country can change it." And I think that was the thesis of the 2008 campaign. And there were ups and downs along the way, but I look back on the work that I did and my colleagues did, and I absolutely believe that together, people who loved this country, we changed it. Yeah. And sorry, you got me going.
No, that's fine. Go ahead.
But I do think that, so in addition to the millions of people whose lives are absolutely better because Barack Obama was the president as opposed to somebody else, I also think that this broader idea that can politics still work if we get involved, if we don't give up, if we don't just kind of read through Twitter and freak out, but we actually take action, can we do something important? I think we validated that, and I hope that the next generation of people changing the country takes that away from the book. I mean, this is a funny book, but you know, funny speeches for the president used to have what we would call a serious close. And I did want to write a book that is mostly funny, but it does have its own serious close. And I think it's about the importance of public service and politics.
You know, specifically with the current administration, President Trump is famously off script at times. That's, in fact, some of what his supporters like about him. I wonder, have you talked to any of the speechwriters in the current administration? Have you compared notes? Do you have a sense of what this experience is like for them?
This may surprise you, but we're not buddies.
fair enough.
I haven't. I think that the speech writing, from what I understand, they've downsized the speech writing operation pretty considerably and also given more the speech writers more weight in terms of policy. So, for example, Stephen Miller, who's the current president's chief speechwriter, is also right now busy trying to derail the a potential compromise around protecting Dreamers. And instead trying to limit legal immigration. And I will say something I learned from being a speechwriter and being a young speechwriter is there are policy people that are there for a reason. So I think that there's a real concern to me that speechwriter, you know, that Stephen Miller is playing that dual role. And it goes beyond the speeches and it goes to the, you know, the kind of overriding professionals in the government. And the other thing I would add about that is I think what is so strange about watching President Trump's speeches is President Trump does what critics of Obama claimed that Obama did, which is he doesn't seem to have a real connection with words he reads off a teleprompter, off a page. And then, as you pointed out, when he goes off script, you get a sense of who he really is. Something I think we were all very proud of in the Obama White House as a speechwriting team is that there was a lot of consistency, that President Obama didn't write every word himself because he didn't have time to, but in addition to all the speeches he did write himself, he sounded the same whether he was giving a 3-minute video about Thanksgiving or delivering remarks off the cuff about some very important personal issue.
Before we let you go, what are you doing now? You're working for Funny or Die. What are you doing?
So at Funny or Die, I am our head writer in the D.C. office. And what that means is we work with our writing team in L.A. to use comedy to get attention for causes that deserve it. One of the hard things right now is just breaking through. I mean, there's so much stuff on the internet. There's so much stuff in the world that it can be hard for worthy organizations or campaigns to get attention that they need to thrive. And so we're using comedy to help do that.
You had a piece in the Washington Post just yesterday, I believe, about what you like about living in Washington, D.C. You still sound pretty hopeful about life where you live and life in this country.
I am. I think of myself as a long-term optimist. And I think that is the nature of the book is not, you know, a lot of Washington books, people start off idealistic and they end up cynical. And I'd like to think that I ended up both idealistic, but also a little more clear-eyed than I started, but not cynical at all. I think when I think about DC, I mean, I think about the people who are still moving there, just like I did, because they truly believe that they can play a small part in something big. And I think that particularly now in the Trump era, in the Trump presidency, I think the hope was that people would give up. I think the opposite's happening. I think you see more and more Americans, especially young Americans, realize we can't take this thing for granted. This country is special and exceptional, in large part because of our institutions, because they need to work properly, because politics needs to reflect the will of the American people. And right now, if those things aren't happening, no one else is going to come save us. No one's going to make that happen. We need to make that happen ourselves, and I think it will.
Well, I wish we had more time. That's David Litt. He's a former speechwriter in the Obama White House. He wrote the book Thanks, Obama, My Hopey, Changey White House Years. That book is out now. And David Litt, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been great.
When we come back, we shift from Washington to Topeka and this week's latest Kansas Supreme Court ruling on school funding. Advocates who've been fighting for years now go back to the legislature again to find the money that the court says Kansas schools need. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. And welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. On yesterday's program, we met mega best-selling author Dan Brown, and Kansas Senator Barbara Beaulieu and the mother of Sandy Hook victim Dylan Hockley talked about keeping kids safe from gun violence. You can find both those conversations at kcur.org. Steve Kraske will be back on Monday. We'll learn how developers can improve troubled neighborhoods and avoid pricing people out of their old neighborhoods. Also, he'll hear strategies for bridging American divides. That's Monday on Up to Date. This past Monday, the Kansas Supreme Court issued a ruling that landed, not for the first time, like a bombshell in the world of state education funding. The justices ruled unanimously that Kansas schools, even after the most recent legislative session, overrode a veto from Governor Sam Brownback and delivered an additional $300 million or so over the next 2 years. Even so, still was neither adequate or equitable under the state constitution. The latest ruling in the so-called Gannon case also delayed the enforcement of the order, giving the legislature until next April to try again and resolve the issue. Today, we're getting reaction to that ruling from some of the debate's most vocal participants around the state, and we're trying to plot the way forward for school funding in Kansas after Gannon. Let's start with KCUR's Sam Zeff, who's been covering this case literally for years. Hello, Sam.
Since I walked in the door 3 years ago, I've been covering Gannon.
Well, and doing so quite well. This was Gannon 5, this decision. Remind us what the Kansas legislature did earlier this year to be responsive to Gannon 4.
So in the last legislative session, they worked and worked and worked. There was a special House committee. There was a select committee in the Senate, all looking at various education funding formulas and schemes, and they finally came up with one that pumped an additional about $300 million into the system over the next 2 years. Now, I have to say at the time, there were a lot of Democrats, a lot of moderate Republicans who didn't think that was enough, but they voted for that formula to move the process forward to get it to exactly where we are right now. And put it before the state Supreme Court, see what they had to say. Would it pass constitutional muster? And it failed on both adequacy and equity.
Right. Those are the two standards the court has laid out.
Yes.
You have to give enough money and it has to be distributed fairly among all the school districts in the state.
Essentially.
Why wasn't it enough?
The Kansas Supreme Court, now there were a number of formulas that were used, one called a successful school model, where they took about 40 school districts around the state and said, looked at how much money they spent and then look at the outcome and said, well, you know, here we have a model for how we can successfully spend money, the proper amount of money, and get the results that we want. The Kansas legislature looked at that and said, not at all. It's too small of a sample. They had a lot of other problems with it. So the legislature, gave them kind of a range of options. Now, the Supreme Court has never, ever said, here's the dollar figure you have to hit. But there is a record.
And why don't they say that, Sam?
Because the Supreme Court doesn't talk about this, but a respect most believe that is a separation of powers, that the legislature does, in fact, get to decide how much we're going to tax and spend. However, it has to be within constitutional bounds. So the Supreme Court, in its ruling, went back to the record and said, we heard from various experts, the Kansas State Department of Education among them, and there was a range of about an additional $500 million to a little over $1 billion that various people said this is what you need to adequately fund education in Kansas. The Supreme Court enumerated those in its ruling, didn't give a figure, but essentially, I think, gave them a floor of about an additional $500 million needed to do that. Now,
it's a lot of money.
It is a lot of money, but they've put $300 million in for the next 2 years. In all honesty, since income taxes have been raised, revenue has been doing better than expected. So it may not be the monumental lift that some expect, but it's going to be a difficult lift in a very contentious legislative session.
Well, no kidding. We certainly have had a share of contention, and even if the court was unanimous, the response to their decision has certainly not been. Let me bring in our other guests. Alan Roop represented the plaintiffs in the Gannon case. He's an attorney in Wichita, and he's joining us from there by phone this morning. Hello, Alan.
Good morning.
Dave Traubert is president of the Kansas Policy Institute. He's been a vocal opponent of the court's previous Gannon rulings and this one, too. He's joining us by Skype this morning. Hello, Dave.
Good morning.
And here in our studio, Mary O'Halloran is on the board of Kansas Families for Education. She's also a regular on KCPT's Ruckus. Mary, welcome to you.
Thank you, Brian.
So let me start with you, Alan. Alan Roop, you're obviously pleased with the ruling. Do you think it lays out a clear enough direction for solving this problem, which the court said is a constitutionally deficient model of funding Kansas schools?
It does. It provides a pretty clear path for the legislature in determining what they need to do to fix the unconstitutional funding problem for Kansas kids. And the court is respectful of its role and respectful of the legislature's role and really doesn't jump in and say this is the number, as Sam indicated. They didn't say that. But what they did do was give some guide stars for the legislature to follow. And probably chief among those is what the State Board of Education did when they looked at those Rose factors to determine what it cost to attain those.
These were factors laid out in a previous Supreme Court case that said this is what's required to be adequate.
Right, and it was a Kentucky Supreme Court case, and there are a number of factors, but they boil down to having kids vocational ready or college ready when they graduate from high school. And the State Board of Education said that number was about $893 million over 2 years. And the court pointed to the studies that have been done, which are somewhere between 1.2 and 1.3 when adjusted for inflation. They gave direction from what the trial court had said, and what the trial court did when this case was tried in 2012 and the decision was rendered, the trial court issued an order that the legislature needed to go back to the pre-cuts in the Montoy era. So it would be to what was
right.
What
and
was
Montoy is another Kansas Supreme Court decision even before the Gannon case that set out a set of standards as well.
Right. And in that situation, in the wake of Montoy, you could see the results in high school assessment tests.
Sure.
You could hear the results from educators on what they were able to do when they had the resources to do it.
Well, let me stop you there, Alan, because I think let me give Dave Traubert a chance to respond. As obviously, you, Alan, are pleased with the decision. Dave Traubert, you are not as pleased. You see this issue differently from the justices. But as Alan was stating, there's a long history of findings that school districts in the state just aren't getting sufficient funding to educate kids well. Do you still disagree with that?
I do. I think that there are this. We were not surprised by this decision. There is. I'm sorry. I'm getting some feedback here.
You sound fine to us. Go ahead.
Okay. You know, once again, the courts and the education lobby have demonstrated that this is all about money. They have a strong sense of entitlement to whatever they want. And this has nothing to do with how we are really going to close achievement gaps and raise achievement for all students. It's simply about money. I mean, it's basically saying almost $14,000 per student that's currently being provided won't be enough. The schools are on record actually saying they think it should be closer to $1.7 billion, and that would push it almost to $17,000 per student. You know, if money was the answer to closing these achievement gaps, there would be no issue. Legislators, I think most legislators would happily provide that. The challenge is that we all know that that's just not been the answer. We've spent billions of dollars more in Kansas and across the nation. If money was the answer, we wouldn't have achievement gaps. But the achievement gaps have actually gotten worse in Kansas. We used to measure the time it would take to close gaps in decades. Now, over the last couple of years, we have to start measuring them in centuries. And getting to that point, getting to close the gap, doesn't necessarily mean that we would have high achievement. To give you an example, on the most recent National Assessment of Educational Progress reports, Kansas only has about a quarter of the low-income students proficient in reading and math, and barely half of the more affluent kids are proficient. We need to get to, and I frankly don't think this court will ever look at anything that's truly based on outcomes. We know the schools do not want to be held accountable for outcomes. They just want money.
Well, let me come.
There's going to be any chance closer to this.
Appreciate that. And we'll come back to you, Dave, here in just a second. We're also going to try to get your audio maybe better a little bit. But Mary O'Halloran, Dave's raising the question that to the court it seems to be about money, and it does seem to be about money. He's right about that. The court says there just isn't enough going to the school districts. The court also said, though, that the most recent legislation made some positive strides. Do you agree with that? And in this context, how do you see the decision?
Well, the positive stride was more money.
That's the big change that was made.
Yes, and it is. It is all about the money.
Will this decision change anything? Do you think there is more money out there to give?
Oh, indeed, I do. Well, the legislature, of course, they can decide that for themselves, and they will and they must. I think, Brian, one thing I want to emphasize as a citizen commentator here today is that this decision, I think, can reasonably be called great, because it has the capacity to end the battle over school funding in the state of Kansas. They have this magnificent, the justices' statement at the end when they're talking about remedies, where they say, as of July 30th, 2018, we will refuse to allow ourselves to be placed in the position of being complicit in the continuing deprivation of thousands of Kansas school children in terms of how they are supported in educational excellence. And so they simply say it'll be over next year. Not all the justices agree with that. Three of them said this should be done faster rather than slower. So I think that the parents And your listeners who are regular voters and supporters of Kansas Excellence in Education can really feel good about this decision.
I want to ask those listeners, those voters, to react and to join this conversation. What is your reaction to the latest ruling on school funding from the Kansas Supreme Court? More importantly, what do you think should happen next? Would you personally be willing to pay more taxes so schools could be better funded? What other government program do you think the state could live without or with less of? Let's get your ideas at 816-235-2888, 235-2888. Just on a technical basis, Sam Zeff, the legislature does have a pretty tight timeline coming out of this court ruling.
Yeah, sure does. Mary alluded to the June 30th deadline. That's the deadline that they've already put. This is unprecedented, by the way.
It is.
That they've already put a briefing schedule in this order. June 30th is when they're going to rule. April 30th, though, of next year is when the legislature is going to have something to show to the state Supreme Court. That means they're going to show up in January. They're going to have hearings. They're going to have floor debate. We don't know where Jeff Collier, governor in waiting, where he stands on any of this and how he's going to play into the negotiations. But they're going to have a bill done and have their brief ready on April 30th so that there can be oral arguments, and then they'll also answer each other's briefs. And on June 30th of next year, we'll have a ruling. It is very tight indeed.
Right, which means they don't convene again until January. Right. So it's agenda item number one.
It is, and I do. I just want to jump in real quickly and say that my reporting has already indicated there are lawmakers who are already meeting about this to try to come up with a plan of action so they hit the ground running in January.
Mary, with your political analyst hat on, what seems likely to happen? To you?
Well, if you don't mind, Brian, I'd like to just a couple seconds to tell you what I would hope would happen.
Please.
The Kansas City Star, in its wonderfully written editorial on this subject a couple days ago, recommended to the legislature that they take a look at the income tax in the state as the source of returning to pre-Brownback records of funding. If the state simply went back to the income tax structure that we had in 2008, for example, they not only could fund this formula for educational excellence well, they would have enough money left over to take care of some other programs that were really seriously cut during the Brownback years.
Brian, can I respond to that? Because that's just not accurate.
Go ahead, Dave Traubert.
First of all, the tax bill that was passed this session, when it's fully implemented, in fact, already implemented, the amount, the $591 million increase for the current fiscal year, put Kansans farther behind than they were before the tax cuts were enacted in 2013. The rates might be lower right now, but the tax collections are at record levels because what Marianne and others don't take into consideration is that the higher cigarette tax and the higher sales tax is already there. Legislative Research did an analysis with the Department of Revenue and found that the net effect of tax cuts going into the 2018 year that we're in now was just $394 million.
So, Dave, here's my question, though. The decision is the decision. The Supreme Court has ruled and says that there is more money needed. What would you recommend the legislators do now?
Okay, and that's a great question, Sam, and let me
this
jump
is Brian,
in on that.
Because, actually.
Oh, I'm sorry, Brian. Both Sam and Mr. Roop indicated that the court seemed to have a great deal of deference to the legislature, which I find laughable. As you just said, they told them they must spend more. That is telling them what to do. They can try to be cute about saying, we didn't give you an exact number. But as others have said, they gave them a floor. They gave them they're giving them direction. And they're also saying, if you don't pay the ransom to our satisfaction, that we're going to close schools. They didn't come right out and say that, but everybody understands that that's what they mean. And so let's go back and look at what the court said previously. They said that it seemed roughly that 75% of students in Kansas were doing fine. There was only about 25% that we're really behind. And so what the court is really saying here is that if you don't pay our ransom, then we're going to deprive 100% of students of the right to get an education.
All
and
right.
That's why I think this is just a horrible decision.
But and
again,
I believe
it's all
you
about money and politics.
Well, but, and I believe you that you think it's a horrible decision, but still it has to be answered by the legislature. Alan Roop, you were one of the plaintiffs in the case. What's your solution?
Well, in terms of the notion that we're doing our best or that we have spent all we can spend, there are a number of headlines that have said in the past, we can't afford this, money isn't available to accomplish this, it would create financial problems for the schools. And those headlines came in about 1957 in the wake of Brown versus Board of Education. And what I would tell you is what the court has said is that this is a matter of constitutional rights. And, of course, it involves money because it's in the financial article of the Kansas Constitution that says you've got to have suitable funding. But this is really about Kansas kids. And in terms of a solution, I think everybody needs to keep in mind that we need to provide an adequate education as defined by those Rose factors for all Kansas kids. And we need to spend what it costs to do that. And we're going to have to figure out how to do that some way. I don't know what it's going to involve. Certainly taking back what was cut and putting it back into the coffers. It's a really good part.
Okay, and but, I appreciate that, Alan. But Mary, what I'm hearing from everybody is okay, more money, but nobody's clear exactly where that money's going to come from or how it can happen.
Well, I just made a suggestion of the income tax. I'd just like to say, Brian, I think that we need to reiterate that the voters of the state of Kansas had a chance to express themselves about whether they trusted this court, the current sitting court, to deal with this question fairly and other questions. And they did not recall a single one. They returned the entire Supreme Court to its future terms. And, the voters want this solution. You know, if you read Article 6 of the Constitution, it's very clear. It's not ambiguous. It says the legislature shall finance and the legislature shall fund an adequate education. It doesn't say adequate, but it's close.
There isn't any
ambiguity to it, I don't think.
Let me take a call from Chris. Just a second, Dave. Yes. We're going to take a call from Chris in Prairie Village. Hello,
okay.
Chris.
Yeah, you keep asking about how much money we're going to spend, but you don't ask how you're spending it right now. Why does Johnson County have 6 school districts and all that administrative overhead that has to go? That's money that's not going to educating kids. It's going to just pay a bunch of puffy salaries.
Well,
until that is corrected, you will never solve the problem.
Yeah, I appreciate that question, Chris, very much. Thanks for calling. And let me ask you, Sam Zeff. I mean, how is the solution to this problem only in the hands of the legislature? Could school districts answer this court ruling by changing how they spend the money, Sam?
They absolutely could. Consolidation of school districts has happened in the past in Kansas. There's now 286 school districts across Kansas. Many of them are very small, by the way. There are school districts with just 100 or 200 kids in some very unpopulous counties in Kansas. But the consolidation, the doing away with school districts, or even if you and there already is a lot of shared services in different districts around in the city or in the state. Can they be more efficient? Well, I think a school district would say yes, but not to the tune of being able to find hundreds of millions of dollars more to put into education. One other quick thing that I want to say. Dave is right that it's not just an income tax solution. Revenues are on the increase because we have raised taxes. There's going to be another revenue estimate in November, so that will be a little bit more of a guidepost. So it may not fall entirely on income taxes. On the other hand, income taxes are lower now, even though they've been raised and they were in 2012.
Let's hope, Sam, that it's not going to be a sales tax increase. Let's hope that.
let's add Dave Traubert. Go ahead.
Okay, so we have. One of the issues here, and again, I think I've talked to an awful lot of legislators who said, look, if they really believe that just spending more money was the answer, they'd be happy to do it. It's not so much, I know some people have said, where's the money going to come from? The bigger issue is that just spending more hasn't and will not make a difference here. We have citizens would like to have, you speaking of the consolidation issue, there are ways, and I know the schools, Sam, do believe that there could be some money saved by combining some services across districts without consolidating the actual districts. But it would, over time, easily save a few $100 million. The data is out there to demonstrate it. The challenge is the political will isn't there with local school boards. Citizens, on the other hand, overwhelmingly approve of it. We've tested this in scientific polling across the state several times over the years, and it crosses all ideological lines as well as geographical boundaries, where there is strong, like 65% to 70% support for providing service, non-instructional services through regional service centers, which are school districts.
So, Dave, in the last seconds,
schools themselves don't want to do it.
We only have a minute left, but I want to ask you, Dave, and then you, Alan, if you could write the legislation right now that should be in front of legislators in January, what's the top piece of that legislation? They have to answer with something, even if you don't like the decision, Dave. What should they do?
I would go back to a system that was developed in 2015 by Senator Steve Abrams and Representative Ron Hyland. They took a different approach to funding. It didn't look anything like that old system.
10 seconds. What was that system?
It was a variation of successful schools. It was basing the outcomes for the those who are not low income on anywhere from 85% or so, 80 to 85% of kids who were above grade level. What were those districts spending? And looking separately at funding low income. But it was funding cost centers rather than just a straight, the way it's done now with weighting.
And Alan Roop, let me give you the last word. What's the number one priority for you come January in the new session?
Well, I think we return to the formula that was tried and true, and the courts have put their blessing on in the past, and that's some form of the formula that was SDF-QPA. It works, and I will categorically disagree with Dave. You can look at the times Kansas has put additional resources into education, and you can see the results in the state assessments.
And Mary,
we're
out of time, Dave.
Because they changed the assessment.
Cut you off, Dave. I can't. We're out of time, but except to say, Mary O'Halloran, one last word.
Well, the people of Kansas can be proud that the moderate voice in education has found a stronger voice in the Supreme Court of the state in their decision.
That's Mary O'Halloran. We also were joined by Alan Roop, who represented the plaintiffs in the Gannon case, and Dave Traubert of the Kansas Policy Institute. Thanks to all of you. And KCUR's Sam Zeff as well. Thanks, Sam.
My pleasure, Brian.
Our podcasts and previous programs are at kcur.org/uptodate. You can follow us on Twitter at @KCURUpToDate and follow KCUR on Facebook, too. Join Steve Kraske on Monday to talk about neighborhoods trying to redevelop without pricing out the residents who live in them. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Justin Garnett. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date.